me pones un éxito. Si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real story. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Meet Carla Kaplan. She is the Davis Distinguished Professor of American Literature at Northeastern University. She has published 7 books, including Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Woman of the Black Renaissance, and Zora Neale Hurston, A Life in Letters, both New York Times notable books. She has written for such publications as the LA Times, the New York Times, Slate, and The Nation. Kaplan has held fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Humanities, among others. She serves on the board of Biographers International Organization and is Society of American Historians Fellow. Kaplan earned her PhD in English from Northwestern University. Today on our show, we talked to Carla about her new book, Troublemaker, The Fierce, Unruly Life of Jessica Mitford, a journey that's told like no other. Dr. Kaplan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Let's kick it off. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us how you got involved in this journey and this work.
Well, I got involved in the journey of doing biography and archival research almost 40 years ago because I just discovered that I had exactly the nerd's qualities of being completely happy in a really badly lit, poorly ventilated archive going through somebody else's boxes of financial records. I can't explain to you why this brings me joy, but I discovered that going through archival materials brings me great joy. I discovered this when I was working on Zora Neale Hurston. And the way I ended up editing her letters and creating that book is that I was teaching at Yale University. And I don't know if you've had the pleasure of working in the Beinecke Library ever. It's a really ugly building from the outside, but from the inside, it's very unusual. It's built out of marble and the light just pours through the stone and it's completely sort of set apart from Yale, which as a Yale faculty member, I really needed. And it had all of these materials of Zora Neale Hurston's and it had all of these letters of hers in which we got a rather different Zora Neale Hurston than we see in the fiction, than we saw in the essays. We got a sort of more up front, a little more in your face. And I thought, people have to see these. So I ran around for years saying to everybody I could find, I was dragging people off the bus stops in New York saying, you ought to edit Zora Neale Hurston's letters. And of course, nobody bit. So I ended up doing it. And I wrote that book as what people have called it, an epistolary biography, a biography told through letters. And I discovered in the process of doing that I was an archival scholar and a biographer, which I hadn't known. I thought I was a theorist. So, okay, now I find out I'm an archival scholar and a biographer. And then I got to run around the country with that book. Because when that book came out, this was a very strange moment in American history. When I published that book of Hurston's letters, there was not yet any book of a Black woman artist, writer, or intellectual's letters published in the United States. Mm. So, I mean, that's incredible when you think about the combined racism and sexism Black women have to face, how important their private letters are for how they cope with that, and we didn't have such a book. So the book was a little bit of a happening, and I got to run around the country and talk about the honor of doing it. found out how much I like the microphone, and I really do like having a microphone, and found out I was a biographer. So the next trade book I did was, you mentioned it, Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. And that book, the White Women of the Harlem Renaissance, grew directly out of the Hurston Project. Because Hurston, and not everybody knows this, had all of these white women friends. They were really important to her. Now, many of these relationships were completely vexed. Her relationship with Fanny Hurst, they were really intimate. But whenever they traveled together, Hurston drove and Fanny Hurst sat in the back. So they were intimate, but there was all this racism. Right? So, like, you have to like find your way through this morass of contradictions. She had all these white women friends. They were part of Harlem. She kept mentioning, you know, I saw Josephine Cogdell Schuyler at the NAACP dance. I saw, and I wanted to read a book on these white women. I thought, well, who are these people, right? What were they doing in Harlem? I think I'm talking to you in Harlem, right? So, you know, what were they doing at 135th, right? Why were they there? There was no book on them. I kept looking for a book on them. So eventually I had to write the book on them, because if I wanted to read it, I had to write it. So I wrote a book on the white women of Harlem. And the truth is, most of them are pretty sad stories. You know, they came into Harlem in the 1920s and 30s filled with good intentions, and most of them were failures. They were failures as allies. They didn't understand what their role meant in a Black social, political, artistic movement. And it's a sort of, it's a tale for our times for sure, but it's also really in some ways a group biography of a bunch of failures, people with good intentions, but who didn't really succeed. I knew the next book had to be about a successful ally. Had to be. For one thing, I couldn't stand the pain anymore. I had to find a story of somebody who didn't just have good intentions, but who really succeeded in crossing social lines. Hmm. And I had looked pretty much my whole career for a woman writer and activist who was funny. I really wanted to tell the story of a committed activist who people enjoyed being with. Because, you know, there's this myth, it's really longstanding, that female activists are grim and earnest and cheerless and absolutely no fun to be around. And I thought, please, let me tell the story of one. And then Jessica Mitford lands in my lap. And the thing about Jessica Mitford is she's the single funniest activist in American and British history combined. She had an irrepressible sense of humor. It was part of her daily life. It was part of her political organizing as a communist. It was part of her civil rights work. It was part of her fundraising. It's deeply embedded into her writing. She always finds somebody to tease and tweak and make fun of. She's just hysterically funny. She was hysterically funny as a person. So for a feminist biographer who had been looking for a woman activist who was funny and looking for a successful ally, Mitford was an extraordinary gift. So I have spent the last 10 years completely absorbed in her life and her voluminous archives to tell this story of somebody who starts out in the British aristocracy, then becomes an American communist and civil rights worker, mostly in Black Oakland, and then becomes a breakout wild success in her midlife as a writer and reinvigorates the genre of muckraking. And you couldn't make it up.
Mm. A match made in heaven.
Yes, lucky.
Kaplan and Decca, who knew? I wanted to start talking about your book, Troublemaker, because as you just mentioned, you've dedicated a great portion of your life. But as I got a chance to glimpse through it, I got to understand that the way you told this story, totally different. This was a journey of life from beginning towards middle, the end, and so forth. Tell us a little bit about the writing process for you as you're digging into this information. And did you know you would spend 10 years writing this piece?
I'll start with the last question. No, I did not know I was going to spend 10 years. Nobody in my household knew I was going to spend 10 years, and nobody voted for that. Let me just say, nobody, like when the 10-year thing came up on the ballot, nobody hit okay. Nobody voted for that. I had hoped I could do this book in about 6 years. That was the hope. But Jessica Mitford, who was a completely self-educated and self-trained, amazing writer, left behind essentially 600 crammed banker's boxes of material. So on the one hand, the good news was there was a rich archive. On the other hand, the really bad news was there was an incredibly rich archive. So trying to sort of dig my way through that. And then I wanted to understand the topics that she was most interested in. So I ended up reading a lot more about death and cemeteries and funerals and undertaking and cremation and embalming than I ever thought I would. By the same token, when I was writing the chapters on her years in the Communist Party, I had to refresh my own sense of the Communist Party in the United States, and particularly in the East Bay, because the East Bay Communist Party was its own thing. It was very different. It's very different than the New York Communist Party or the Chicago Communist Party. Jessica Mitford, one of her main subjects was incarceration and prison. She was a very, very early prison abolitionist. She was a prison abolitionist in the 1970s. It is possible, I can't prove it right now, I'm working on it, but it is possible that she coined the term prison abolition. Mm. So she was a prison abolitionist really before there was even a full-on national prison abolition movement. There was a prison abolition movement. It was led by incarcerated people, and it was in their newsletters. So, you know, it existed, but she kind of brought it to national attention. So, of course, working on that book of hers, I had to do a lot more reading on incarceration and the prison industrial complex and so on. So that was the sort of body of the bulk of the research and why it took so long. But the other reason it took so long goes to the heart of how you started out your question. And that's that there is already existing out there something Jessica Mitford called, pretty derisively, the Mitford industry. There has been a lot of fascination with these six Mitford sisters for decades. These were six beautiful women, brilliant, talented, creative, vibrant, absolutely full of energy, full of ambition, and they had no outlets. So their brother Tom had outlets. He could have an impact on the world. But the girls, as they were called, the Mitford girls, they didn't have outlets. So they turned to one another, and then they reached up into the air and pulled down imaginary futures, many of them completely unworthy of their talents, some of them shocking and horrific. But they created these lives for themselves, and they were glamorous and they were scandalous. So they have fascinated historians for a really long time. And there's a lot of work on the other sisters. There's much less work on Jessica Mitford. So until I brought out this book, there was one very early biographical book on Jessica Mitford by an historian named Leslie Brody. And then there was a fantastic collection of Jessica Mitford's letters done by Peter Sussman, a book that's appropriately just called Decca. But even though all her sisters had had five or six biographies, Decca had not. And what I discovered in the course of writing this book was how profoundly different her worldview was from her family's. She always said that she had a different way of looking at the world. She, in fact, described it, her phrase was, it was a lonely opposition. But I discovered in the course of reading, because I had to read all the other biographies and all the Mitford histories, and all the Mitford blogs. I mean, it's a crazy world of Mitford mania. There are people who dress up like one of the sisters. So you can tell I'm not one of these uber fans. But I was interested in the phenomenon of the uber fans. I was interested in knowing why so many Americans were besotted with a British fascist. Why so many Americans were completely besotted with a British Nazi or a British Duchess. So that took up quite a bit of the research too. And then, as you say, I wrote a very different version of this family. And through Decca's eyes, this family looks quite different than most of the histories and the biographies and the movies and the TV shows and the plays that we've had up until now.
Well, there you have it. 10 years well spent, my friend.
Thank you.
Talk about early on, the grabber for me, you go in detail, and it's been told, but the way you spin this for me was very legit in that I got a chance to really understand complex information. Decca's decision to run away at age 19 may have been seen as a rebellion act at that age. Teenagers always do that. But yet, there was a moment of supreme self-confidence that we got to learn from her as your story began to unfold, which kind of brought up the keys to her activism.
Yeah.
At what point did you realize that that move would open the door to Decca's aristocratic traits and that then it will be repurposed as a political tool?
Oh, you asked about six good questions in there. I'll try to, you keep track of me, see if I can get through them all. Because that last one's so important. The way she both left her background behind, but always made incredibly strategic use of it as a leftist, as a civil rights activist, as a writer. She abandons aristocratic privilege, but she uses aristocratic manner. So we're going to come back to that because that was a really big thing. There was a period in writing this book when I thought I might start it with her running away with Esmond Romilly at 19, because there's a sense in which her full real life begins when she's 19 and she runs away with him. Up until that time, she's living very, very cosseted in privilege and comfort in the Cotswolds with her right-wing family. And even the ones who aren't active Nazis and fascists have fascist leanings, have fascist support, are apolitical. Her oldest sister, Nancy, a famous novelist, was sometimes liberal, but lived by gender terms, the most conventional of lives under the thumb of a man who never reciprocated her feelings. So Decca was the rebel in the family, the leftist, the socialist. She found out about socialism in her teens. She wrote away for as much literature as she could get. She had to have it mailed to the house in the Cotswolds. The girls all grew up with an incredible family library, one of the great British libraries in British hands, in private hands. It had been their grandfather's library, but it didn't have any books on socialism. So when she discovered socialism, she wrote away. She started reading about it. As far as we can tell, she was one of those kids, and you may have been one, I was one, just born with a deep, relentless sense of fairness. You know, I was that kid who not only said, why isn't my allowance as big as my sister's, but who also, you know, couldn't bear to see people living on the streets, didn't understand why some houses were bigger than others, didn't understand why some people had more money than. And of course, I had wonderful socialist parents who just said, oh, you're right, honey, it's not fair. So a lot of kids have that sense of fairness. And then they later kind of outgrow it and abandon it as adults, unfortunately. Well, Jessica Mitford always had that sense of fairness. She had it from the time she was a toddler on. She looked at the British class system and she said, this makes no sense. Why do so few people have everything and so many people have nothing? This doesn't make any sense. And she never abandoned that view. Her sisters, on the other hand, who all benefited from their incredible upper class status, never questioned it. So the question for Decca was never, why did she have a sense of fairness and they didn't? The question for her was always, why didn't they have a sense of fairness? Why didn't they see how wrong the class system was? But she had grown up as the lone figure in the family who questioned everything the family depended on and everything the family took for granted. So at 19, she got the opportunity to meet her second cousin, Esmond Romilly, Winston Churchill's nephew, but more importantly, already a famous rebel. He had run away from boarding school at 15. He published his first book at 16. He fought in the Spanish Civil War. He was in the Spanish Civil War with the Republicans so early, there wasn't yet an English brigade. When Esmond Romilly got himself to Spain to fight in the Spanish Civil War against the fascists, there wasn't even a volunteer English brigade. He was one of the first Englishmen there. And he fought with a brigade that was mostly German and Italian because that was what was available. and he ended up being one of the only survivors of that brigade. The battalion in which he fought, fought some of the bloodiest, most horrific battles of the Spanish Civil War, both in Boadilla and in Madrid. Almost all his immediate comrades were killed. He almost died of horrific dysentery. He was invalided back to England to recover. And then it was his job to go all around England and tell the families of the fallen how their loved ones had died. Wait, talk about a grim job, right? Mm. So he had more or less recovered. He was still a little bit weak. He had made his tour of grim news, and he was having a weekend at his at a cousin or an aunt's, at a relative's house before returning to Spain. And Jessica Mitford maneuvered to be at that weekend gathering. And over dinner, she leaned into Esmond Romilly and she said, "Will you take me to Spain?" And he said, "Yes." And essentially that was it. They ran away to Spain. And it was in Spain, I think, and through Spain, that Jessica Mitford truly became who she was for the rest of her life. And so I had thought about starting the book there, but then readers wouldn't see everything she had left behind. And I think readers needed to see what she eschewed and what she abandoned. But what she saw in Spain, and this was true for progressives all across Europe and all across the United States, was a lesson in solidarity. And it was a lesson in solidarity that for people who lived through the Spanish Civil War never left them. Because here was a war being fought against fascism, being fought in defense of a democratically elected people's government. And it was being waged by volunteers from all over the world who were willing to die for principle. So, you know, talk about walking the walk, right? Mm. These were thousands of people coming from all over the world. They weren't Spanish. They weren't connected to this part of the world. Many of them were not Europeans. Most of them were not soldiers. They were not trained. And they were signing up to do this out of deep belief, and many of them died. And Jessica Mitford witnessed this, and she witnessed what it meant to put yourself on the line for other people. And I think it was a profound political education, as the Spanish Civil War was for many, many people. And here she's married to a veteran of this. Oh, because she runs away with Esmond Romilly. They're lovers within 3 days. They're married within 3 weeks. So, and that was kind of foretold. She'd been in love with him as a legend even before she met him. So she, you know, she's in love with and living with one of the veterans of the brigades. She's witnessing all of this. And it creates for her a really profound sense of what it means to make a political commitment. That you have to just, you have to take risks, you have to change your life. And so compared to what people were losing in Spain, I think she was able to say, giving up my aristocratic family isn't such a big deal. Giving up my wealth and privilege isn't such a big deal. I am not dying on the battlefield. They knew all kinds of people who did die on the battlefields of Spain. They knew all kinds of Spanish refugees who were running from Franco's fascism. And it put her own struggles in a kind of perspective, if you will. But it also gave her a model that of what it meant to commit yourself to other people and to commit yourself to their struggles and to understand their struggles as your own. Because for so many people who went to Spain, the fight against fascism was not just a Spanish fight. It was their fight as well. And the idea was that if Spain fell, democracy would fall around the world, that, you know, the fall of Spain would matter to all of us. So everybody who was there had a global perspective. And that was, I think, profound for her, and it formed her political life. Now, she went on to be an American communist, a civil rights activist, to do all kinds of other work. But I do think that period was formative. So I did have this idea for a year or so that I'd just start the book there. I'd start the book with her in Spain. But as you know, I didn't. I started the book with her growing up in her aristocratic family with all that wealth and privilege so that people could see what she turned her back on.
I want to like backwards plan here a bit. That conversation between Jessica and her mom about the why is it not fair? Yeah. Why does these guys have to not live the way we do and so on. And mom's response to that was like, oh yeah, I kind of see your point, yet that's just the way that things are. And as you are learning from this, I saw that for me, those that are privileged, even without the wealth, privilege in itself has impacted the way we do business still today. So a lot of what I got to read early on in your piece was, this is not only factual to what happened to her life, but it still remains as a battle that we from urban communities have to still go up against when things are not heard or when our needs are not met the way that they should be. Tell us a little bit more about that family guilt that kind of shaped Decca's dedication to anti-racism in America.
So I'm so glad you put it that way, because the more I read about this family and her, the more it resonated with everything that was happening today. And then, of course, there was the horror of the last election and our turn towards fascism in this country administratively, not yours and my turn. I'm sure we're turning away, but there's this nation's turn towards fascism right now. And suddenly this story became even more resonant for me. But one of the things I noticed also about the family was not just their inability to question their own comfort and privilege, but their profound disinterest in other people. And I began to see that disinterestedness as a characteristic of privilege. That privilege does a kind of damage to the privileged. It blinds them. It makes them less curious. It insulates them. It isolates them. And for whatever reason, we'll never fully know the answer to why she came out so differently. But for whatever reason, Jessica Mitford was unable to adopt that disinterestedness. She was fascinated by other people. She was a profoundly curious person all her life. She had almost a childlike curiosity. You know, she was just interested in everything. And she would meet people and she would meet young activists and they'd tell her their ridiculous little stories. And she was honestly fascinated. You know, so she would say to the students at University of California at Berkeley, "You're so interesting." And she really meant it. I mean, she was just deeply interested in other people. And it made her notice, and it made me notice, her own family's lack of interest in others, her own family's lack of curiosity about the world, and how damaging it was to them. That disinterestedness, that disengagement allowed two of her sisters to become fervent, hysterical fascists. Her oldest sister, Diana, married the head of the British Fascist Party, lived her entire life as an unrepentant fascist, went to her grave saying the Holocaust was the fault of the Jews. And her most beloved sister, Unity, went to Germany, stalked Hitler, became his intimate. When Germany and England declared war, Unity took a little pistol out of her purse, put it up to her temple, and pulled the trigger. She actually lived for 8 more years with a bullet lodged in the back of her head. It was lodged at the back of her brain and back of her skull, and they couldn't get it out. And she had very diminished capacities, and it finally did kill her. But that disinterest about the world made her sisters, in spite of all the Mitford industry attention to the other sisters, they're actually not that interesting. The only way I think somebody can be really interesting is if they're interested in other people, if they're interested. And Jessica Mitford was an incredibly interested person, and it makes her so much more fascinating than her sisters, but it also created distance between her and her family. So starting in Spain, she has a running buddy who's as interested as she is. Esmond Romilly is also a deeply interested and curious person. And they have quite a wild time. They go to Spain. They go back to working class England for a little while. They're living on the other side of London from either of their families. They suffer a terrible tragedy. They have an infant daughter who dies of measles. Then they leave the United States. They make their way to America. And Esmond has this idea. Esmond always had an idea. Most of them were bad, but he always had a great idea. And Esmond's great idea was that they would tour all around America giving lectures for the Americans on what the British are really like. So he had all these lecture topics that was supposed to be like the inside story of the British aristocracy. Well, nobody was terribly interested in that. So they had to get jobs. He found all kinds of absolutely weird jobs. He was a door-to-door silk stocking salesman for a while. They also ran a bar in Miami, Florida, which was pretty funny because they knew nothing about business or money, let alone running a bar. But they did that for a little while. And when the war was declared, when the United States and Europe entered the war, he signed up with the Royal Canadian Air Force. And he actually signed up. He was trained to be what was then called an observer, but we would now call a navigator in the Air Force, somebody who maps exactly where the bombers are going so that they drop their bombs on the right targets and that they get back safely. It was one of the most delicate jobs in the Air Force. It was one of the most complicated, detail-oriented jobs. Esmond Romilly was notoriously absent-minded. Esmond Romilly, if he were a modern person, he would be the guy to whom you lend your car and then who comes home from the party in an Uber and to whom you say, "Where's my car?" And he would say, "Did I take your car?" I mean, that's Esmond Romilly. And he was not a good navigator. He didn't have that skill set. Unfortunately, he was killed within months of serving. He was shot down over the North Sea. And Jessica Mitford was completely alone in the United States during wartime with a infant daughter. They had their second daughter then. No resources, estranged from her family, disowned by her parents, and she had to make her own way. And it was just incredible how bold and brave she was. And I needed readers to see that bravery against the comforts she grew up in. Because now she's really on her own.
Well told, Dr. Kaplan. And I think that to me is why your writing is so unique. Although this is supposed to be history, there was a love story here that you shared with us and made it, you know, readable, but also visible for those that just listened to your response there, that Esmond and her, they were like a perfect match. They really didn't know what they were doing anyway. But early on, she encountered loss. And think about that.
Yeah.
Even though the risk and all the things that they kind of did, it kind of put her in a path early on in life to be confronted with the reality of what the real world is. Loss, love, and all these things that make you eventually resilient. Yet the writing, the creativity for someone who did not go to school, and these one-liners and poems and things that she was able to put together, concrete upper lip and forging ahead and all these things that still stay today. What was the feeling for you as you began to piece this together in this powerful book, but also what were you feeling as a woman as you were seeing this unfold?
Well, thank you for asking that, because you know, the biographer's relation to his or her subject is a very weird and complicated thing. When you write a biography of somebody, particularly one that is heavily researched and attempts to put them in the historical context, that person is in your house. That person is a third member of the household. Sometimes that person you spend much more time with than you do any of the living flesh and blood members of your household. So I spent a lot of years with Jessica Mitford before I understood her, I think. It took me a long time. And I don't think the problem was so much gender, although I am a very avowed feminist, and she had ambivalence about feminism. She didn't like the label, but if anybody accused her of not being a feminist, she had a fit. So she had some mixed feelings about that. But I had trouble getting to know her for a while, I think because of the ways in which she carried forward her aristocratic background. One of the things she carried forward from that background was a refusal to focus on her own feelings, that concrete upper lip that we associate with the British, and particularly with the British upper class. She took that to extremes. And one of the ways that she dealt with all of the tragedies in her life, it was the death of her beloved first husband, Esmond Romilly, who was larger than life, charming as hell, incredibly funny. He was imperious and not very sympathetic person, but he was absolutely, you know, a great love of her life and a wonderful, wonderful character. She had to deal with his loss, the loss of her daughter, and then she lost a son who was just a young boy when he was killed by a bus. So she had a great deal of loss in her life, including her family. And she dealt with it all, and she forged ahead by refusing to talk about it ever or refusing to dwell on it. So her own feelings were something she never wanted to dwell on. In fact, she had a phrase for it. What she called people who focused on what they felt, she said that they were grubbing about. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm an American. I'm a modern American. I'm a modern American feminist, and I'm a Jew. So, okay, I have spent my whole life grubbing about in my feelings. So, and I like grubbing about. I actually kind of, I teach my students to grub about. I think grubbing about is important. I grew up with the motto of the feminist movement, the personal is political. We taught each other to grub about in our feelings and to do that, right? To treat that as a diagnostic for what was wrong in society. Well, Jessica Mitford had no interest in any of that. She didn't talk about her feelings. She didn't dwell on her feelings. And she wasn't interested in friendships that were focused on feelings. So much so that at one time in her life, so this is in the late 50s and early 60s, during the Montgomery bus boycotts, in fact, a friend of hers was suffering terribly through a set of horrible losses in her own life that had devastated her health. This friend had become so traumatized by loss and death that she was suffering from incapacitating migraines and her systems were shutting down. And she wrote her friend, Jessica Mitford, and said, I don't know what to do. This is my suffering. And she described her suffering. And Jessica Mitford wrote back, here's what you should do. Start collecting shoes for the bus boycott. That's what you should do. Like, she just wasn't interested in the personal. And for her, it worked. It allowed her to take her losses and her tragedies and the pain of losing her family and keep moving forward. But it also made her hard for me to get to know. And it took me a while to understand that that was the way she dealt with pain. And that the less she said about something, the more I better look at it as her biographer. Because if she wasn't talking about it, it probably mattered a lot. So that just took a while to figure out. Because she was very un-American in that way. I think, you know, most of us as Americans take a certain amount of grubbing about for granted.
This, again, to me was one of the stellar moves that you did here. Just as you finish explaining, usually we deal with trauma and loss a certain way. She self-medicated and kind of led the way. And this is how you really deal with it. You don't even talk about it. You just keep going, forget about anything. It didn't matter. It wasn't worth it. The energies weren't right, whatever you want to call it. But I think that you allowed and will allow the reader to see this and make up their own mind. Was she really masking or was she as tough as she said? Tell us a little bit about what was the most difficult chapter for you to write in this piece and why?
Ooh, that's such a great question. There were two chapters that were really difficult for different reasons. So can I answer that with two chapters?
You got it.
Okay, so the most difficult chapter emotionally was her death because I just couldn't stop crying. By the time I had to write her death, I had really, really come to know her and I had lived with her for so long and I got her by then. And in her death, in her facing her illness, we see how incredibly tough she really was. So when she was diagnosed with cancer in 1995, it was just complete metastasis everywhere. It was just, it had really exploded. It was in her brain, it was in her bones, it was all over her body. And she was with her daughter in the oncologist's office, and the oncologist was showing her the images of everywhere in her body where the cancer was showing up on screen as a white area. And he was pointing to the screen and he would say, that's cancer, that's cancer, that's cancer, that's cancer. So it's just, it's everywhere in her body. Now, you know, most of us, you know, would have not been able to get through that kind of a consultation. And if we did get through it, we'd get through it in a puddle. You know, it was just the worst news. She was only 79. I mean, she was not that old. And according to all reports, she didn't shake. She never cried. She had two questions for her doctor. And she also refused extensive medical treatment. She said, can I take my summer vacation with my family? And how long can I write? How long can I write? Who does this? I mean, who? Another way we find out how tough she was, and you mentioned self-medicating, is I think it won't surprise your listeners to learn she was a very serious alcoholic. Her alcoholism came on later in life. She was a social drinker, and then the social drinking became drinking alone, and then the drinking alone became getting up in the morning and in her bathrobe pouring one mug of coffee and one mug of vodka. And it would start at 7 a.m. because she put in the 14-hour workday every day. She mm-hmm. was an incredible worker, but she was a worker on vodka. And when the doctors said to her towards the end of her life, it was already in the 1990s, you have to quit drinking. So somebody with decades of drinking and drinking, as you said, to self-medicate terrible pain, she stopped cold turkey. She wasn't going to go to one of those dry out centers, and she wasn't going to go to a group because you know what they do in a group, right? Mm-hmm. What do they do in a group? They grub about. She's not going to do it. She's not going to sit in that circle, you know, and talk about her feelings with a bunch of strangers. So here she is, somebody who's drinking vodka at 7 a.m. And when she decides to stop drinking, she puts it down and never takes another drink. Mm. Who can do that? So she absolutely was made of steel. It is true. I mean, there was a piece of her that was just a steel core. And the parts that could get past that steel, she medicated or she bracketed. That's my sort of take on her. But I think she was unbelievably bold and steely and brave and tough. And it was very hard for me to write her death. She had a wonderful death in many ways. She had the death she wanted. She died at home, surrounded by her friends. They were all singing her the English and American ballads she loved. She was trying to correct them when they got the lyrics wrong. She had the death she chose for herself, but it was an early death. It was younger than it should have been. Intellectually and historically, the chapter that was hardest to write for me was the chapter about why she left the Communist Party when she did and why she didn't leave sooner. Because I knew this was an issue for people. So Jessica Mitford joined the Communist Party in the 1940s at a period when if you were a really progressive person in America, if you were committed to anti-fascism, if you were committed to anti-racism, the Communist Party was doing that work. That's who was doing that work. That was who was developing a systematic analysis of institutional racism. That's the organization that had Black leadership. And so she joins the Communist Party. She's very proud to be a communist. She works with the party for many years. And then, like everybody else, she is hit with the revelations that Khrushchev makes public of Stalin's atrocities. Mm-hmm. And lots and lots and lots of people say, oh my God, she was horrible. She didn't quit the party that day. And I had to answer the question of why didn't she quit the party that day? And what I discovered is she didn't quit the party that day because she felt accountable to all the people she had recruited into the party. So most of her political work was in Oakland, California. She was working on housing discrimination issues, labor issues, and police brutality issues. She was working with working class Black Oakland, and she brought a lot of working class Black Oaklanders into the Communist Party. She felt she couldn't turn around and just quit the party and abandon them. And she was looking to see if there was some way that the work they were doing in California could be salvaged in some other organization, some version of an American party with no ties to the Soviet Union, if there wasn't some way to salvage that political work and not just abandon it. But it was a very difficult chapter to write because people tend to see that period of American history in very black or white terms, that if you didn't leave the party on day one, there was something wrong with you. You were, you know, a company man. She was never a company man. She was anything but. And also because there's so little understanding of communism in America today. And now, of course, you know, thanks to this completely lunatic administration we're living with, we have these wild, insane things that are being said about communists. It'll be interesting to see if Mamdani can turn some of that around, right? If Mamdani can be, you know, I don't know, we can't get into Mamdani. I don't know what your feelings are about that election, but you know, I mean, it's very interesting what New York has just done. And so that was just historically and intellectually a very hard chapter for me to write, and one that I struggled for a long, long time with.
Again, you brought real heavy information, and the reader is going to get a treat when they get to read Troublemakers, because I think that you get to see through your pen and paper a life that was just beyond exceptional. You got someone who self-taught and became probably one of the greatest writers ever.
Unbelievable writer.
Huh?
Unbelievable writer. Amazing.
So these are the things that when people get to see this, the way you built on this and let it just flow, which is what I thought was so nice about this. For me, a lot of what you shared there, the code of the streets, if you will, is you can show gratitude, but never forget, but you can forgive. Like, there was a time that she wrote a final letter to Bob. Tell us a little bit about that gratitude and forgiveness despite being betrayed. And was this a decision to like forgive because I just want to close out, or it was just to show this is one of my core values?
So that letter, which I did include as kind of a block quote in the book, I tried not to do too much block quoting because I didn't want the book to look too academic. But sometimes you just have to hear Jessica Mitford in her own words. You just have to. And that letter almost broke me. I mean, that letter was so moving. So it was written a couple nights before she died. She knew she was dying. She was set up at home in a rented hospital bed. The cancer had overtaken her body. It was taking over parts of her brain that were immobilizing her left side. She was still able to speak and to think, but she was partially immobilized, and she was sleeping in what was essentially the living room of their Oakland house, and Bob was sleeping upstairs in their bedroom. And she decides to write her husband a letter about her death and about how it feels to be downstairs dying and how that feels to her and how she wants him to maybe look at that once she's gone. And the letter is the most beautiful and moving thing because it is completely honest about how she says, it's so weird, Bob, to be dying. It's such an odd feeling. And it's so kind of matter of fact, but also deep emotionally about, I suppose the letter also moved me so much because she did talk about her feelings in it. She and Bob had gone through their own difficulties, like most long-term marriages. If a marriage survives, there's often a crisis in it. There was. She had felt betrayed. She made the choice to stay. And at the end, she also made the choice to be completely loving with Bob. And what she does is she thanks him for the great life they've had. And it's so moving because she could have still been angry. She could have talked about the betrayal. She could have had the last word. God knows when you're dying and you're writing a letter, you can take the last word, right? She doesn't. She thanks him for a really great life as comrades and friends. I can't imagine what it must be like to be somebody who gets a letter like that, to be somebody who receives such a generous letter. That generosity of spirit was part of her core value with those she loved, not with political adversaries. If somebody was a political adversary, an exploitive capitalist, a fascist, a Nazi, a racist, a prison guard, a cop. She was merciless. Okay, those people got no mercy. They were just, she was going to just do them in with her wit and with her words. But for the people she loved, she was very generous and allowed people to have all kinds of room to make mistakes and to hurt her and to still come back from that. She had a very generous spirit with those she loved. And when she loved somebody, she loved them with incredible loyalty. And if she fell out with them, it was an enormous trauma for her. Towards the end of her life, she had a terrible falling out with one of her three best friends, who was Maya Angelou. And the falling out was over Clarence Thomas. And I don't know if your listeners will remember or not that Maya Angelou was his big supporter, to everybody's shock and concern, right? What was Maya Angelou doing supporting? I mean, this is before we found out really how bad Thomas is, right? But there were a lot of indications right away of who he was going to be. And they had a huge falling out over it. Decca was appalled that Maya Angelou would support Clarence Thomas. And she wouldn't back off of her view, but she was afraid she was going to lose her best friend. And she didn't sleep for a week. I mean, she was absolutely beside herself in pain that she might lose one of her best friends. And when they got back together, Maya didn't particularly apologize. And Decca didn't require that. She just moved on. So with those she loved, she could be very, very open-hearted and generous.
And I'm going to quote you now. Who does this? To be honest with you, so much beauty in this incredible book that you have offered. I know this is going to be a smash. It has really been an honor to really get to meet you and really listen to your thought process, because I got to read some of the pages and really immerse myself in that. But you gave us an opportunity today to kind of put the words into picture. And as we sit here and listen, we visualize this process of what a great woman she truly was. A person who was loyal, who was willing to lose, give up everything, start all over again, make sure that those that were the less unfortunate had an opportunity, a real pillar of social justice. I mean, in so many ways, what do you want our readers to get out of this book?
Two things, I think. One is that part of what made Jessica Mitford so great is that she was not perfect and didn't try to be. She was filled with flaws, including what the kind I mentioned, that she wasn't a very sympathetic friend emotionally. And she didn't concentrate on her flaws. She concentrated on her strengths and she moved forward. So I think that's nice to remember because, you know, aside from you and I, maybe not everybody's perfect. I don't know. The other thing I want people to take away from the book, if they can, or that I hope the book helps people with, is her spirit. And what I mean by that, and I think her spirit speaks to the current moment. Many of us feel a lot of despondency right now over the shape of the world, the way it's going, you know, whether it's what ICE is doing, or fishermen being bombed and killed in Venezuela, or what just happened at the University of Oklahoma, where now teachers aren't allowed to even grade a paper without losing their jobs. I'm a teacher, so I feel this one particularly keenly. Or whether it's the completely insane racist rant coming out of the White House about Somalia over the last 3 days. You know, we hear this stuff and it's not a cartoon. It's actually the world we're living in. And it's hard not to be depressed. And it's hard not to despair. Every day, my international students talk to me about their terror. And my trans students ask me where they should go to be safe. Where should they move? And it's hard not to feel sad. Jessica Mitford fought this and more. She lost a husband to fascism. She fought fascism and anti-authoritarianism all her life. She got up every day to fight the bastards. Oh, can I say that on air? Sorry. She got up every day to fight authoritarianism and tyranny and fascism and to have a good time. She was her principle as an activist was she was not going to let them take her life from her. She was not going to let them destroy her fun. She was going to fight them every day, and she was going to have a dinner party, and she was going to go to a concert, and she was going to make a new friend, and she was going to laugh about a joke. And she kept up the fight by keeping up her spirits. And I don't know about anybody else, but I need that right now. I need to be reminded that that's how we're going to get through this. We are going to get through this by keeping up one another's spirits. And that's how we're going to keep up the fight. And that's what I want people to get from DECA.
Dr. Kaplan, talk that talk. The floor is yours. Before we let you go, any parting words for our listeners about getting troublemakers, about your mission, and what's next?
Troublemaker is available absolutely everywhere and in all formats. So it is audio, it is Kindle, it is print. Make sure whatever format you get, if you're reading it or you're looking at it, has the 87 photographs. I fought really hard to get those into the book, and I think they're kind of amazing. And I thank you so much for getting to talk to your readers about this great figure and this journey I took.
We listening. They say that mountaintops are the epitome of one's incredible journey. Yet the most times we forget the backstory. And you told us today, the rocks, the lost pebbles, the shapes of the stones, and even the slippages. They are the true triumphs of us not getting to the top. These are the peaks and valleys. Because on this platform it was built. Because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Dr. Kaplan, thank you for such an amazing conversation.
Thank you.
OMG.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just. At He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa. This is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde de la Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, mamá. Te extraño mucho.